Can you hear me? Fantastic. Thank you very much. Well, it's a particular honour to be asked to present here, not only because this is one of the finest universities in the Netherlands, but also because the Hague is the birthplace of Raymond van Barneveld. Any fans of the Barney Army? Hey! Nice one! Right. So, let me introduce myself. My name is Oliver Thorne. I'm English. I'm the second of your all-male panel today. And I'm a professional actor. But I also lead a double life, because when the British government decided they wanted to triple the cost of attending university, I decided that was slightly unfair. So I started filming myself in my bedroom, telling the internet what I'd learned in my lectures today. 5 years later, that is now Philosophy Tube, the YouTube channel. It's got just under 200,000 subscribers. And that pays all my bills, and that's my job when I will act. And that's the capacity in which I've been asked to speak today. I have to say, when I was asked to speak at a conference on the future of AI in warfare, I was very sad, because that meant that somebody, me or you or the organizers, found it easier to imagine a future in which AI is involved in warfare than we do a future without warfare. And so, over the course of this short talk, I'm hoping to challenge and dispel some of the popular assumptions about artificial intelligence, and also about the ethics of warfare itself. First, I'm going to be explaining two myths about artificial intelligence and why they're wrong. Then I'm going to be talking about warfare and how we can forefront an ethical approach to it. And then finally, I'm going to tie the two strands together and talk about AI's role in obscuring ethical problems. Before we go any further, not to jump on all, but we're going to need some kind of a working definition of AI, which isn't really a very easy thing to come by. But the military and defense industries, are already referring to autonomous systems. Now, as I'm going to be explaining shortly, I believe that we need to, as a matter of urgency, retire the word autonomous when we talk about AI. I think it's very misleading. But it's the word we're stuck with for now, so I'm just going to keep putting it in scare quotes. To understand autonomous systems, it helps to contrast them with automated systems. An automated system is a very simple machine. If X, then Y, same input, same output. An autonomous system works probabilistically. It compares the inputs it receives to a database in order to figure out what it should do based on the goal that you have previously set it. Now, either you have to give it the database before you turn it on, or you have to tell it how to gather the database in order to operate. You also have to tell it its goal. The role of a human being in telling the system what its database is and the goal it must achieve is absolutely vital. Please bear that in mind as we go on. Because they operate probabilistically, an autonomous system can give you different outputs. It doesn't always give you the same result, which means that it can be quite useful in situations where there's a lot of uncertainty, for instance, in a war. So let's jump right in. Two myths about AI. Myth one. The myth of objectivity. A lot of people think that algorithms and AI systems are unbiased and objective. They are not. They are absolutely not. An AI system can inherit all of the biases of its creator, including racism, classism, ableism, transphobia. These problems do not go away just because you introduce a robot in there. And to illustrate this, we're going to have a fun example of that. We're going to design a social media platform. It's going to be bigger than YouTube, it's going to be bigger than Twitter, it's going to be bigger than Facebook, it's going to be you Twitter, right? Now I'm going to volunteer. Someone put a hand up? Somebody to be a venture capitalist. Hello, what's your name?
Hi.
Thank you very much. You're going to be our venture capitalist, you're going to fund you Twitter. Can you pick a number between 1 and 20, please?
14.
14, thank you. You've just given us $14 million to develop you Twitter. It's going to be fantastic, thank you very much. So guys, welcome. We are the U2FACE team. We're the team of the future, we're the team of today, we're the team of yesterday. Just grab a beanbag anywhere in Silicon Valley, so it's a particularly casual brand of evil. Today, our task is to figure out how things get trending on U2FACE. So every time you log into social media, you've probably seen something that looks like this. The trending news box, right? Our task for today is to write a system, an algorithm, that determines what appears in that box, okay? Easy peasy, right? All we have to do is write a program that says, what are the most popular words being used on the platform right now? Stick it in the box. Done. That's what's popular. That's what's trending. Right?
Yeah.
You know what two words are always the most popular on every social media network? Lunch and weather. All the time. They're always trending. If you write an algorithm that just takes the most popular words and sticks them up there, it's going to be hashtag lunch and hashtag weather all day, in every time zone, right? So, okay, what we do is we take a program and we say, all right, find the most popular words. If it's lunch or weather, filter it out. If not, stick up there. Congratulations. Just created an algorithm that is biased against reports on climate change. Everybody who talks about climate change, who posts about it, who links to it, who tells people about the research they've just done, is going to mention the word weather. You just created a trending news algorithm that has a conservative political bias. Without even meaning to. A trending algorithm has three jobs. It has to gather the data, it has to filter it, and then it has to publish it. At all three stages, a human being has to say, do this, don't do that. So at all three stages, bias can creep in. And this actually happened to Facebook a couple of years ago. They got in trouble for this. It was a similar scenario. Now, we're very used to the idea that a newspaper or a news network can have a political bias. It might be like Fox News, right? Really badly. If you're very clever, you might already know that, in fact, every newspaper and every news media station has some political bias in one way. But for some reason, a lot of us think that an algorithm is objective. So why do we think that? Well, let's return to being the U2itFace team. Now, as a U2itFace team, we've got to give you your money back, because you invested so much money. So how do we, as a social media platform, make money? We need to make the platform friendly to advertisers, right? Advertisers use trends in order to get their ads in front of more eyeballs. Now, how do you think advertisers are going to react if we admit that our algorithm is biased, i.e. not accurate? It's not a good look. Now, we could hire a whole diverse range of people to jump in at all three of those stages and help us kind of correct the bias, or at least have a bit of diversity. That's going to be really expensive. Oh, and we can't tell anybody what the algorithm actually does, because it's our private intellectual property, and some rival social media platform could steal it. So that's how we arrive at a situation in which massive private companies like Facebook and Twitter determine what news people get to see, how they see the world, in a biased way, with no accountability or oversight. Because everyone involved has a really strong incentive to pretend this is objective, but it isn't. Let's take another example. Far more serious one. My venture capitalist friend. I know that U2itFace didn't quite blow up the way I wanted to, but I've actually just got a brand new idea. It's going to be really cool. I'm going to pitch it to the mayor of the city. Who'd like to be the mayor? You know, volunteer? Anybody? Who's going to be elected? Thank you very much. You're the new mayor of Hay. Thank you very much. Madam Mayor, you've got this brilliant idea, right? It's an algorithm that can tell police officers where they need to patrol, based on all the crime reports we give in areas, right? So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to take all the arrest records and all the crime records for the whole city, I'm going to plug them into an algorithm, find patterns, and the algorithm's going to say something like, send a few more police officers down Brand Street because there's been a bunch of murders there, right? So if you give me a taxpayer's grant to develop this algorithm, it's you and me get our money back, I make a bit of money, crime's going to go down because the police are going to be where they need to be, the police are saving time, the people are going to be safer, I'll even employ some of the local people to help me build the software, so I'm creating jobs, I'm creating wealth for the city. Madam Mayor, does that sound like a good idea?
Sounds like a brilliant idea.
I call it smart policing, right? It's going to be brilliant. It sounds great. Until you realise that the police in our city disproportionately stop black people, disproportionately arrest black people for the same crimes as white people, and disproportionately interpret the innocent actions of citizens of colour as resisting arrest, thereby legitimising greater police force. And that white citizens of our city are more likely to call the police on citizens of colour for doing absolutely nothing. How many of you saw that thing happen? That very thing happened in America recently. Two black guys hanging out in Starbucks waiting for a friend, and a white lady got nervous, called the police. It turned up, they were arrested for doing nothing. All of our data is going to wind up in the algorithm. The algorithm's going to tell us you need to send more police into the government in black neighborhoods. We've just made racist policing faster, cheaper, and more efficient. Now, As the developer of smart policing, am I going to admit that? No. If I even realize it. Are you going to admit, Madam Mayor, that you just unleashed the racist computing service in the city? Yeah. The police sure as hell aren't going to admit that they're institutionally racist. Oh, and by the way, because this algorithm is my private property, it's not going to be released to the public. So the citizens are not allowed to know or have any accountability over the system that is being used to police them. And yet everyone involved is going to tell you it's great. It's working. In case any of you think this is sci-fi, this technology has already been tested in Los Angeles and in Santa Cruz. Myth number one, AI is not objective. Myth number two, the myth of autonomy. AI systems are not autonomous. Anybody who tells you that they are is probably trying to sell you one. Autonomous means having the freedom to act independently. AI systems do not act independently. They do what they are told to do. So as an example, you're driving along, you're driving really fast, and suddenly a kid runs out to the road. You've got a split-second choice to make. Do you hit the kid, or do you swerve and you hit the car next to you? Now for today, don't worry about which choice is necessarily the correct one. But the point is that with a human driver, a decision just gets made, split-second. Also, as a human driver, whichever decision you choose, you can be taken to court. And the people taking you to court might not win, but you can be required to stand up in public and be accountable for your decision. Now swap the scenario. Let's say it's not a human driver, it's a self-driving car, autonomous vehicle. The decision is not made on the spot. The decision was already made by some program ages ago, who programmed it, not directly in a kind of if-then way, but programmed it to interpret the world in a certain way, to gather data in a certain way, to have certain goals. Maybe not even one program, maybe a whole team of programs. But nevertheless, some human being is responsible for the decision that gets made. And here's the real kicker. Well, that's a slogan to remember. AI systems are not autonomous, they are unsupervised. Here's the real kicker. If a car swerves and hits someone, a self-driving car, who do we take to court? Can we take the programmers to court? Can we take the software company, the car company, to court? Because if not, then some software company has just been given the unaccountable power of life and death over everyone its product encounters. Elaine Hirsberg was 49. And she was hit and killed by one of Uber's autonomous vehicles in Arizona in March. Her family has since settled with Uber out of court, so at present, there is no legal precedent for deciding questions like this one, as far as I know. So, some human being is causally responsible for this woman's death. Now, whether that amounts to criminal responsibility, we may never know. But of course, companies that make the AI systems have a very strong incentive to tell you that they're autonomous, because that means they're not responsible. But they're not autonomous. They're just unsupervised. So to recap, two myths about AI. They're not objective, they're not autonomous. With these things in mind, let's turn our attention to war. The night before, we're going to need a definition of warfare. And fair warning, this is going to get pretty bleak, but I'd like to lead you to a definition of warfare in a bit of a roundabout way. I'd like to imagine that you wake up tomorrow and you check the news, or you check Twitter, or you check the phone, and you see that the worst possible crime has been committed. Don't worry too much about what exactly it is or a rigorous definition of the word worst. Just imagine whatever would give you the most horrible feeling, the most sickening, the most repulsive crime you can think of. It's been done. In August, I became the proud uncle to a baby girl. She's absolutely gorgeous, she's in joy. She's a light in my life. So for me, I imagine the worst crime, the thing that makes me feel the worst, is somebody harming a child. And I just scale up from there. So I imagine that I wake up tomorrow and I check the news, and not just one child, but every child in my country is dead. It's about 14 million children in the UK, about 4 million here. Everyone under the age of 18 is gone. Maybe some of you have younger siblings, maybe some of you have seen yourself, but some virus, some nanomachine, something is just gone. No one's going to work. Everyone's calling in saying they can't get kids to wake up. Public transport's not running. The Prime Minister's not even making a statement because, you know, they've got their own family. No one can even be cobbled together. Whole economy's ground to halt. There's just screaming filling every street. Silence in every school, every playground. Now imagine we caught the guy who did it. He's deliberate. Some mad scientist, he engineered the virus, he engineered the nanomachine, whatever he did, he's deliberate. We caught him. And the question is, what do we do? Now, I'd like to remind you of something. That neither my country nor this one has the death penalty. There is literally nobody who has the power to put that man to death, to take away his life. No one can do it. To kill him is legally murder. And even in countries where we do have the death penalty, we can only apply it after a fair trial. So here's the multi-million dollar question. On whose authority do we kill the foreigners? When we go to war, we kill people. We don't just kill them, we kill them by trial. The worst possible criminal, the worst criminal, is entitled to a fair trial in a jail cell, even after everything that man's done. You don't even have to be a criminal if you're foreign. You don't have to even have to be arrested. No trial, no charge. So this is the definition of warfare I'd like you to keep in mind today and hopefully in the future as well. Warfare, state-sanctioned killing of foreigners without due process. Now let's say a few things about this definition before we move on. The first is that I'm very aware that warfare involves more than just killing. I spend enough time around soldiers to know that their job isn't just shooting people dead. And other definitions of warfare could capture other aspects of it. This isn't meant to be comprehensive. I just want to forefront the ethically contentious bit of warfare in your minds, which is killing. Secondly, I interpret the word sanctioned here to be an active word, to be actually doing something, not just sitting back and condoning the death of foreigners without trial, but actively getting involved in the process, maybe through an invasion, as my country, and I believe this one did in Iraq, maybe by sending money and weapons, as the Reagan regime did to fascist governments in Latin America. Or maybe, as my country is currently doing, sending military advisors to Yemen. All of those, I would say, are included in an active definition of warfare. Thirdly, we should all, I hope, be aware that plenty of state-sanctioned killing of actual citizens goes on without trial as well. You're probably aware of the extrajudicial killings of black people in the United States. It seems to be happening a lot. You may also be aware that in my country, since 1990, 1,400 people, predominantly people of color, have been killed following contact with the police and some police officers in charge. Those, I would say, are all morally horrific, but not today coming under the scope of what we're calling warfare. And lastly, I don't want to overstate the ability of a fair trial to find what is just and good. I'm sure we're all aware that fair trials can sometimes be biased in their own way. I'm just trying to tease out a particular contradiction that we'll get to shortly. So, the state sanctions killing the foreigners without a trial. This definition and the thought experiment of the worst possible criminal makes it pretty clear that when it comes to killing people, it's one rule for citizens, and it's another rule for everyone else. And in this way, we can see that citizenship is the first weapon in a war. Citizenship determines who may live and who may be killed. There's just one example of one I'd like to tell you, the brief story of Bilal al-Bajani. Bilal was British. He was born in 1940, went to school in St. John's Wood, North London. In 2010, he was stripped of his British citizenship by then Home Secretary Theresa May. He may not actually have come to state this, I think I actually edited out of my PowerPoint, but he was stripped of his British citizenship. Theresa May, you may know, is our current Prime Minister. On the 21st of January 2012, Bilal was in Somalia, and he called his wife in London to congratulate her on the birth of their third child. Hours later, he was killed by a drone strike by the Obama regime. Now, the United States government had been watching Bajawi since 2006. They even gave him his own code name, Objective Pecker. And he was on one of their kill lists, so it wasn't an accidental killing. They were hunting for him, and they found him. And here we see that citizenship is the first weapon. With his citizenship gone, he's no longer under the protection of the British government. And the Home Office of my country has declined to comment on whether they knew he was going to be killed when they stripped him of that citizenship. Now, I don't want to comment on Bajawi's character today, and I don't want to comment on his political beliefs. But what's relevant for us right now is that he was never convicted of a crime. He was detained several times, but released. Now, the files that the United States government have on him claim that in 2006 he was sending money to Al-Qaeda, which is a criminal offence in the UK, funding terrorism. They had the evidence for it, they say, but he was never tried. He was never found guilty. And I remind you that even if he had been, the UK doesn't have a death penalty. The worst possible criminal gets a trial. And yet Bajawi was executed. But Bajawi's case, and the many others like it, show us that citizenship is the first technology of warfare. And they throw the issues of AI and warfare into a quite bleak context, actually. I don't want to spoil too much when I'm going with this, but a lot of people think that using AI in warfare, so, oh no, we're going to be making decisions about who lives and dies just based on like a totally cold, emotionless process with no appeal and no oversight. People just don't have any rights anymore because they just put it on the computer screen. Well, actually, we already do that. There's a pair of philosophical concepts I'd like to introduce you to called social death and civic death. Here I'm going to quote from Lisa Gunther in the fantastic book Solitary Confinement. Social death is the effect of a social practice on which a person or group of people is excluded, dominated, or humiliated to the point of becoming dead to the rest of society. Although such people are physically alive, their lives no longer bear a social meaning. They no longer count as lives that matter. Social dead may speak, act, compose symphonies, or find a cure for cancer, but their words and deeds remain of no account. During warfare, we treat foreigners, not just enemy citizens, but often civilians as well, as the social dead. Arguably, actually, I think we treat civilians and foreigners as socially dead all the time, but we're talking about warfare today. Social death is what enables us psychologically to move on to the next stage, civil death, which is what makes killing them legal. Civil death is a legal fiction. It refers to someone who has been legally positioned as dead in law. Their body may be alive and their mind shot, but they've been deprived of the legal status of a person with civil rights, such as the rights to own or bequeath property, to vote, to bring a legal case to court, and so on. Now, before Leonard absolutely leaps out of his chair, I'm not talking absolutely literal here. This is the legal position that people we kill in wars are thought to occupy, but not always literally. The casualties of war are not literally declared legally dead before we kill them. They're just not really thought of as legal entities, as rights holders, or at least not quite to the same extent as we are. And we can see that Bajawi was shunted through both of these categories before he was killed. He was socially dead already, to almost everyone. The newspapers in my country practically celebrate extrajudicial killings like his. And other than his parents, and his widow, and his children, who are all still alive, and presumably at this stage not great fans of British and American governments, who weeps for Bilal and Bajawi? And he was civilly dead as well. We are sitting 4 miles away from the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court. Do any of us really think that Barack Obama and Theresa May will ever be tried for their role in the death of Bilal al-Bajawi?
No.
No one's even going to try it. It's just not even going to occur. Here we see that social and civil death work to make killing without trial not just acceptable, but normal, even expected. Oh, note, by the way, that citizenship is not the only technology of social and civil death. I've mentioned already the extrajudicial killings of people of color in the United States. In that case, arguably race can become a technology of social and civil death. Being a prisoner can, and of course, slavery is the classic example. Killing foreigners without trial is very common, and I think it's very worrying. I worry that it paints a very flimsy picture of what human rights are. As an example, I just want you to focus your mind's eye on the right to life, the right to not be arbitrarily killed. The fact that foreigners can, in fact, be killed without trial paints a picture of this human right, according to which our right to life is not a morally necessary foundation for any human society, but rather a concession from governments to only certain people, a privilege that can be revoked at any time without accountability or oversight. The right to life is something that flows from governments to people, rather than something that people demand of their governments as a condition of governance. And what we've come down to is this. Are justice and human rights moral ideas? or are they purely legal? And it's, I guess it's fitting that we're sitting 4 miles away from the International Court of Justice. What is that building for exactly? And this is where you can choose your own adventure a little bit, depending on whether you think justice and human rights are legal ideas or moral ones. If you believe that justice and human rights are purely legal figures, then the killing of foreigners without trial presumably holds no problem for you. Because citizenship is the legal tool that we use to determine who can be killed and who can't. The Authorization for the Use of Military Force statute, which was passed by the United States Congress on the 14th of September 2011, gives the United States government the legal right to kill anybody, anywhere, anytime, in any country, without trial, even in countries with which the United States is not formally at war, as long as they are the associated forces of Al-Qaeda, which apparently, though it has never been proved in a public court, included Bilal al-Jawi. And that's all there is to it. It's just a legal matter, morality doesn't come into it. It's a great quote from the Joseph Heller on Catch 22, they're allowed to do anything we can't stop them from doing. However, if you believe that justice and human rights are in fact moral ideas, that killing citizens without trial isn't just illegal, but actually morally wrong, and furthermore you believe that all humans have equal moral rights, and the killing of foreigners without trial presents a very serious problem, because it's actually impermissible. Not just bad, not just, probably avoid doing that, but actually impermissible. To do it even once would be wrong. Now notice, by the way, that these two conclusions, war is lawful and war is impermissible, are consistent. You can believe both, but you can't live by both. You can't go to war and believe that justice and human rights are moral ideas. Now, whenever there's a terrorist attack in my country by somebody who isn't white, people like to ask the question, where was he radicalized? Where did he come to the conclusion this was an okay thing to do? I had to put that on his head and ask, when were we radicalized? When did we decide this was okay? When did we all collectively just accept the idea that the right to life, the right to just not be killed, just doesn't apply to foreign people? It's fine. When did Tupi's main radicalized? When was Barack Obama radicalized? When were the US military staff killed Bilal al-Jawi radicalized to believing that they had a moral right to kill a man thousands of miles away? I don't think it's a really crime. Now, to tie the two strands together, we talk about AI, we talk about warfare. The writer Evgeny Morozov cautions that once we create a piece of technology to address some problem, it becomes very hard to question the nature of that problem. Now, as an example, our venture capitalist friend, thank you very much, we're now going to develop a new piece of technology together, and the mayor of the city, thank you. Now, I know you Twitface didn't quite blow up, and I know that inadvertently created a racist computer that messed up the police force, but this time, I've got a really good idea, right? And it's going to be really excellent. And Madam Mayor, this one's going to be really good too. I've invented an app that you can give to homeless people, and it monitors how much space is in a homeless shelter. And it tells the homeless people where the nearest shelter is, how much space it is, how much it's going to cost to stay there, and it helps them find a bed for the night. I call it Sarah, Shelter and Rest for All. We're going to be doing good for the city, we're going to be helping homeless people out. Madam Mayor, I know we've got that really big sporting event coming up, Darts Final, we're going to have that's going to be in town. I know you wanted to clear all the homeless people off the streets because it's not really look good for the city. This is going to be great for that. You give me a taxpayer's grant to develop this technology, I'm doing good for the city, right? Doesn't that sound good? Can anyone spot the obvious problem with that? Anyone? Shout out.
Homeless people
don't have cell phones.
Yeah.
That's actually a very common misconception. A lot of homeless people do have smartphones. The idea that, it's true. The idea that homeless people don't have smartphones is based on a misconception that homeless people just leap out of the ground, poor, and have nothing. But actually, people are made homeless. And that's a hint. This app does not address the causes of homelessness at all. Systemic inequality, exploitative landlords, the institution of private property itself, The fact that you, Madam Mayor, have been selling off social housing to build luxury flats because one of your major campaign donors was a big property developer? None of that is addressed at all. This app sells you, literally sells you, a nice, slick, easy technological solution that stops you actually thinking about the nature of the problem. Remember that police app I talked about earlier on that tells the police where to go? Same story. Doesn't address the causes of crime at all. In fact, it stops you thinking about it. Oh, and remember, everyone involved, from the developer to the mayor to the people funding it, have a very strong incentive to tell you that this app is great and it's working. Just look at how much homelessness has decreased. And this could be a big problem when it comes to warfare. If we create an AI system that can identify a target, not even kill anyone, just identify them, say, like the llama doing, look, there he is. Then we have created a system that hard codes the presumption of guilt, that says, this guy's on a kill list, what do you want to do? Even if the killing is done by a human being, that system doesn't stop to ask, why is this guy on the kill list? Why do we have kill lists? What are the factors that contribute to war and terrorism? How are we feeding into them? Is there something else we could be doing here? Why are we spending money on killing people instead of this? Doesn't ask any of that. Sells you, and again, I mean literally sells you. Private companies are spending a lot more on developing tech like this than state militaries are. Sells you a nice, easy solution that pushes you towards a legalistic interpretation of warfare, that pushes you towards thinking that this is not a moral issue, that it's just about whether it's lawful. In fact, you'll see that happen all the time. If you challenge the police, if you challenge the border agencies, if you challenge anybody and say, this thing you've just done is really morally wrong, they'll respond to you by saying, it's lawful. But that's not the issue, is it? It's not about whether it's lawful. It's about whether it's right. So in sum, artificial intelligence has the potential to make warfare faster, cheaper, and more efficient. We shouldn't be trying to make warfare faster, cheaper, and more efficient. We should be trying to eliminate it. Now, I don't want to end on the down, so I'll ask that in time, what can you do? And again, you can choose your own adventure here, because this depends on whether you think that morality, that human rights and justice are moral or legal. The first thing you can do, if you believe it is a moral issue, is that you can call your representatives. You could tell them that if they want your vote, they need to commit to non-violent foreign policy. It doesn't kill anyone without a crime, and that you expect them to support peaceful foreign policy. You protest. It's a great way to meet people. Get involved, learn about military involvement, get out on the streets and protest if you think this is a moral thing. And this applies whether you think it's a legal matter or a moral matter. Challenge hypocrisy. Whenever you see, when you feel safe, of course, in a compassionate way. But if somebody stands up and says, our country cares about human rights, our country cares about due process, just ask them, do we really? All the time, for everyone? Somebody says, oh, this foreign country, earlier on we had a joke, a casual joke about bombing Kim Jong-un. Somebody says, this foreign country, they don't respect human rights. Just ask, do we? On what grounds do we claim the right to police them for it? Resist the myths about AI. Resist the public relations attempts to sell you on it by telling you that it's objective and telling you that it's autonomous. Again, they're just trying to sell you on it. Elon Musk wants you to think that he's cool, because if you think that he's cool, you're not thinking about the fact that he closed down one of his factories, put thousands of people out of work because they showed it to you. When you think it's a legal matter or a moral matter, just don't believe PR. And lastly, resist attempts to put people in social debt. If by listening to people and cultivating empathy that we can do that, listen to prisoners, listen to sex workers, listen to communities being aggressively policed, listen to citizens of countries that your country doesn't like and is bombing. Listen to undocumented immigrants in detention centers. Resist always the attempts to dehumanize and to reduce people, because it isn't AI that's going to be doing that. People who make AI are relying on you to do that for them. Capitalist friend. you're guilty about your investment.
Hi, thank God I don't have that much money to spend and play golf with. I'm Anna, as you know. My question is, I've learned in one of my classes that that the systems, the algorithms are designed by people. Is the concept of the moral good, is that subject for being implemented in algorithms?
Can you program morality into an algorithm?
Yeah. Can you program morals? Perhaps is my question.
You can give it a go. Certainly. Isaac Asimov had his three laws of robotics, right? Saying, like, don't harm a human is one of the first ones, right? That doesn't make anything to bias, though, unfortunately. But that doesn't make it totally bulletproof, because the kicker is going to be in for instance, if you tell an algorithm, do not harm a human being, the person who gets to define what harm is has a very big control of the situation. Like, some people would say that arresting people and putting them in prison and solitary confinement isn't harming them, but other people would say that solitary confinement is a form of torture. So it's how you decide what morals are. So certainly, yes, you give it a go, but you're still going to be vulnerable to bias. Remember, it's not objective.
Hi. I have a question. You said challenge hypocrisy, right? Whether legalistic or moral. But do you think eliminating hypocrisy about moral issues will improve treatment of the ones affected by that hypocrisy? Will it not detach us from the issue itself? Will it not change into a situation where you start to fight fire with fire if you're not trying anymore to give a moral explanation for your action?
I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean, but in any case, I don't believe that eliminating hypocrisy is actually possible. I think we can challenge it, and that challenging it could, in some contexts, have very good results. But I think to eliminate hypocrisy and ambiguity and human beings being flawed and messing up, I think that's, in order to do that, you have to create, well, if possible, you have to create a pretty restrictive society. So I don't think that we can ever eliminate hypocrisy, but I do think that there can be fruitful results in challenging it, especially if somebody is being a hypocrite in order to sell you on something. If somebody's saying, our country cares about human rights, brackets, and that's why we're going to buy a whole lot of weapons from this really big private company and go and bomb these other people, then questioning the hypocrisy of that can stop you being sold on something. Because it's very easy to say, yeah, I agree about human rights, and then someone goes, great, so let's bomb all those people, and you go, so I think that kind of challenge hypocrisy can be quite useful.
Well, you answered it, so thank you.
Hi.
Hello.
Here.
Hello.
What, in your opinion, could you name one good thing about AI?
Ooh. Well, yeah, it makes things faster, cheaper, and more efficient. But on its own, I don't think that those are always good things. I'm not sure that anything is necessarily like always good in all circumstances. So I'm not sure. I think the question is possibly a little bit too abstract in the answer. But I imagine that the AIs that run my phone and my laptop are very useful. And I help put people into space, help distribute resources more evenly and justly. I imagine we could do a little bit of it. But it's deciding where to put them. That's there.
I'm sure we could have an interesting discussion. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on the concept of a so-called casus belli, a cause for war, the legal construction by which someone goes to war. Because, as you rightfully argue, there's a difference between legal constructs and moral constructs, yet war is also, to some extent, an illegal construct. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, as a designated ethics lecturer, I focused on ethics today. I'm sure Leonard can tell you more about the legal aspects than I can. I know, I believe that I've never been in a position where I've been asked to legally justify a war. I struggle to think of a cause, a legal cause. Because then when you have a state passing laws and deciding who it's okay to kill, then it becomes about like, who has power within that state. So, yeah, that's a difficult issue. Our cops are not really able to say anything that informative about it.
Yeah, I have a few points to make once again. The first one worthwhile bringing up is your argument that algorithms aren't objective, or rather that it is a myth that they are objective. I've heard this argument many times. The most interesting situation I came across so far was an article by The Wired magazine titled, "Can AI be racist?" And I think that's a really stupid question to ask. Okay, the reason the article was written was there was this AI research center that was training its AI on image recognition, and they fed in all the information, right? And for some reason, it is not known why, right? Because of the black box problem that we have in AI. The AI, personally, I find this funny, it's a little bit unfortunate. The AI classified black people in the images as gorillas, okay?
As what?
Gorillas, as in like the animal. Now, that's unfortunate. When asked why that was the case, the researchers didn't know what to say because they didn't actually know why the AI did that, right? So similar to the example from earlier with the husky, right? For some reason, it classified it as a wolf and really it isn't. Anyway, point aside, my point is to argue whether an algorithm can be objective or whether it can be biased is a semantically silly question to ask. It doesn't know what's going on. It's just following a procedure of physics. Does that make sense?
Do you believe that racism is about intent?
Well,
do you believe that bias only matters what people intend to do?
Well, intent certainly is a really important combination. I know that postmodernists, for example, radically disregard intent, which in my mind is an absolutely insane thing to do, but regardless of that, given the topic, which is objectivity of algorithms, I'm saying you're asking the wrong question. It's not about objectivity or bias, it's about mistakes, right? It's about problems. So the AI, in the example that I gave, or in the earlier example with the husky, it's not about whether the AI is biased against, what was it, he classified it as a wolf, right? Yeah, he classified it as a wolf, but it was actually a husky. Oh, is the AI biased against huskies? No, it's not. It just doesn't know what's going on, and it's making a mistake, and the scientists behind us need to figure out what's going on, right? So that's my first point. The second
so,
point,
again, do you believe that it's about intent? Do you believe that bias must come from a place of intent?
I think that it's an important fact, I guess.
Would you deny that unconscious bias can exist?
Oh yes, unconscious bias is utter nonsense, and I can prove that to you. That I mean, the creators themselves have shown that, because unconscious bias is actually not called unconscious bias, that's not its scientific term. Its actual scientific term is implicit association, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I forgot the names when I could give them to you, the two scientists. They developed the implicit association tests at Harvard, I think in the 1970s, 1980s, and what the test does not fulfill is test-retest reliability. Test-retest reliability is an absolutely fundamental concept in any scientific area, and in this case also law to some extent, but point being, and to make it sure, because I also don't want to bore the audience with other irrelevant scientific facts, unconscious bias is nonsense. It's been easily disproven. It doesn't fulfill test-retest reliability. In any case,
that's
unless you want to
just what I said doesn't really require that. It just requires that the systems humans make reflect. Which
right?
Well, the points I was making don't really require that. They just require that the systems human beings make reflect them. Which
well, that's what I'm saying, right? So it's not racist, it's not biased, it's just a mistake. And in this case, maybe a mistake.
Do you think that racism and bias are mistakes? They have to be.
Yeah, I'm trying to cut it short, right? But no, that's not what I'm saying. Right? I mean, this is the third time I was trying to move on. But the other thing is, you said something that which I thought was interesting, was which was the distinction between autonomous and unsupervised. Okay? And I agree this is a very complicated topic, certainly from a legalistic point of view. What do we classify them as? Are they autonomous or not? So question then is, I'm sitting in my car. I'm one of those fancy people that has a Tesla, let's pretend, and I'm driving down the highway, and I put the autonomous mode on, the self-driving mode on. Is the car autonomous, or is it unsupervised?
It's unsupervised. That's the
point. You would say it's unsupervised. But I'm clearly supervising it, I'm just not driving it.
I think maybe you've taken what I would say to be applicable in slightly more of a like, specific scenario. The point I was trying to make is that when people say AI systems are autonomous, I wasn't trying to say that the word autonomous is like never applicable, or the like unsupervised must always be substituted in like one-to-one relationships. I was just saying that it might be illuminating to think of them as being unsupervised from an ethical point.
Okay.
So,
sure.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation and also very entertaining. I think it's something that could be commended because often those conferences can get a little bit dull if we just talk about principles. And that was really a nice way of rounding things up. And I'm going to make a few comments and ask a few questions and be a little bit maybe challenging. Are you making an argument against AI or against the negative externalities of AI? Because I think that a lot of the challenges you mentioned that are current and very accurate in terms of discrimination are things that will slowly get tackled as technological development progresses. I mean, there is a whole subfield of ethics in AI that develops principles, computational principles, to implement morals inside the machine, to give phonesis to systems. I mean, this is something that a lot of research is doing on. So I would say that a lot of the challenges you mentioned are, you know, they might not be so static and incurable. And also, I wanted to ask, are you making the argument that law and morale are self-excluding principles? Because you tend to portray law as a purely formalistic element that is only there to legitimize the power of the strong. And to a lot of extent, you're right. There's a lot of studies done to show this. But a lot of law is also a codification of social norms and of cultural morals. Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to forget about the first one. Sorry.
On that point, I'm coming to my last comment, is that there are laws in war, there are laws for warfare, and there are laws for the maintenance of peace and security. This is why we have the UN Security Council. So my first question was, are you making an argument against AI or against its negative externalities?
Okay.
And the second is, are you saying that law and morale are
self-excluding? I'm making an argument against killing people with whatever tools we have for that. So if that involves AI, then yeah. What I'd like us all to remember is that warfare is killing people. Like early on, Paul said, when you drop a bomb on a tank, you can see it as a strategic objective. As far as I can say, when you drop a bomb on a tank, someone's got to send a letter to that guy's mom. That's what I'm making my point. And the second one?
The second one is that it seems to me you were making the argument that law and morale are self-excluding. Could you maybe expand a bit on that?
Yeah, that's really cool. So I was using law and legal as sort of folk concepts. I definitely think that moral principles can impact how laws are made. But what I think is that AI, and to a certain extent a lot of other systems as well, can push us towards thinking of law as being without moral content. Can push us towards saying, this is lawful and therefore acceptable, when actually we might want to say, it is lawful, but we still should.
I actually have a question about the idea that war is necessarily impermissible. If that is the case, would a slightly violent revolution overthrowing a tyrannical regime also be wholly impermissible?
Good question. I think Alcott's saying I don't know. I think the answer is possibly too. The question is possibly slightly too abstract. Might have to decide on that. But I would say that I would hope that that slightly violent revolution would understand that human life is important and has value, and that eliminating it is not to be done lightly, and is not to be done as a goal in itself. Well, good question. I've had a lot of dudes speaking, and there's a lot of dudes speaking on the panel as well, so are there any people who have objects? Questions? Yeah, I've got one. Accept the idea that AIs are autonomous, i.e. make decisions independently of humans. What I was trying to introduce people to is the idea that they in fact do what they are told to do, even if they produce unexpected results as well. And if some human is involved in creating them, then a degree of moral responsibility persists. So I wasn't really trying to put together like a formula for deciding what is autonomous and what is unsupervised. I was trying to help people appreciate by using the word unsupervised, that moral responsibility can persist even when we are told by people who have a vested interest in telling us that it's autonomous. I think autonomous carries a lot of baggage that we can see clearer if we put that.